This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by St. John's College Graduate Institute, offering discussion-based master's degree programs for Western liberal arts or Eastern classics. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI for more information. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, philosophy podcast by some guys who were one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 120 is something like, what does it mean to will something? And we have Eva Brand here to talk about her book, Unwilling, an inquiry into the rise of will's power and an attempt to undo it. This is Dylan Casey in Annapolis, Maryland.
This is Mark Lintonmeyer in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in San Antonio, Texas.
This is Wes Alwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
Eva Brand in Annapolis, Maryland.
Eva, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Very much.
Eva and I are here in Annapolis recording again, and we had you on last time to talk about Heraclitus and your book about his fragments.
A fan favorite episode that is like the first one that we point them to.
It's one of our most downloaded episodes.
Oh, yeah. I'm flattered, I guess.
We've been reading a number of books about will, and the question of will is pretty topical in the free will debates.
Yes.
And you had this book. It's not your most recent book, but it's one that you came out with not too long ago.
Yeah.
And 2014.
That's not very long ago.
No. Time enough to write another, though.
Yeah. Yes.
Does the writing overlap, Eva?
No. I've got a policy that a couple of weeks before I think I'm finished, I start the next one. Otherwise, I go into decline.
So how long did it take you to get through all the information for this book?
This one, a couple of years, I guess.
Yeah, I remember you talking about it back in 2011. Yeah. So it was a long project.
It was a long project.
And it's monumental. So it's largely a historical overview. You sort of get to your own position at the end, but your own position ends up being pretty much look what Aquinas said and what some of the other people that I said nice things about said. And you don't go into much additional detail about that. But the section on Augustine, one of the ones that we picked out for us all to read, you're diving into four different books to get at all the different things he has to say about will, giving us a much rounder picture than we will get ourselves when we go through the Confessions soon, for instance.
When Eva and I were talking about it earlier, I characterized it largely as a kind of genealogy of will.
That struck me as just right. It had two separate births, Augustine being one and Aquinas the other.
You start off the book almost apologetically saying, well, so this is sort of what I think, and then going through the historical coverage, and then at the end saying a lot more about what your position is.
It's partly a pretense not to know at the beginning and then to work your way to a grand conclusion. It always begins with a conclusion.
Yes.
Pretense is that it's an inquiry.
Maybe you could talk for a minute about just the title.
Unwilling with a hyphen. I'm unwilling means I don't want to. And to be unwilling means to be against something. But there happens to be a use, I found it oddly enough, in Elizabeth Barrett Browning, the poetess. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to say poetess, but she was a woman. She uses it as undoing the will, to unwill. So unwilling could be the activity of undoing the will. Mm-hmm. And I conceived of this book as giving that a try.
Maybe as a way of beginning with the end, you could sketch the basic arc of your argument.
Yeah.
In particular, what's objectionable about the will and what this thing that you're proposing in contrast to it is?
I guess I have to come to that. In antiquity, let's say among the earlier Greek philosophers, the great ones, Plato and Aristotle, even though some of the terms they use are sometimes translated as will, there's nothing like the will that Augustine discovers and that Thomas works out. So I begin by claiming that the will is an invention. Then Augustine is the first one to think of the will in the way that I think we should unwill, namely as a clenched fist activity or ability or power. Thomas has a kinder and gentler notion of the will as being desire that is rational, so either rational desire or desiring reason. So there are two grand traditions, one of which is more or less lost, and that's Thomas's tradition. And the clenched fist one is really the one that wins out. At the end of the book, I conclude that it would be wise to undo the will to a certain extent. Not in a clenched fist sort of way, but in a relaxed sort of way. And I think as we go, that'll become clearer.
One of the connections that you made in the book to a philosopher that we've covered in the past that I think made this very clear was the one to Heidegger. Heidegger's concern with technology just has to do with some sort of overall attitude of dominance, that everything that I encounter, I don't even really see it in itself. I just consider it as a tool for my action. And that with that goes a lot of society's ills. And you even connect that near the end of your book. And some of this was my reading into it based on the fact that I know that you don't use email and wrote the book out in longhand, but the resistance to technological change, not whole hog, not that you live on a farm and eschew modern conveniences, but don't want to put a lot of mental time into figuring out new things if that's going to distract from what's really important in life.
It isn't really resistance. It's mild disinclination, more or less.
It's paying attention to those inclinations and not trying to, the clenched fist type of will goes along with any attempt, Christian attempts, other attempts like that, even anti-Christian attempts like Nietzsche's to remake yourself in some radical way, in some strong way. I will, through the force of will, make myself into a new kind of being. And that seems to be what you are, that it's much better to be relaxed and curious and paying attention to things as they are in themselves. So Heidegger puts it as let the being be. Although I understand that you even reject Heidegger's take on that as sort of too passive, that no, we need some active engagement.
Yeah, lest anyone think that Heidegger plays a positive role in this, he plays, to my mind, a most terrible role in it. In the first instance, his way of giving up the will is to give it over to the Führer. That was his Nazi period, and there are speeches in which he actually speaks of giving over one's will to the leader. Then later on, when he's over that, he has a theory of letting go, but he runs into terrible trouble because he can't find a way to let go without willing that. In other words, the question is, when you're letting go, isn't that an act of the will? And he has no solution to that. So Heidegger is not my hero. But you mentioned Augustine and Nietzsche, and they are really central in very different ways. Shall I say something about that?
Please.
Augustine really discovers the will. He discovers it as a power of perversity, and in particular as a power of resisting God, and even more as a power of trying to be God. In other words, the notion of becoming a divinity, of exercising the will to dominate, that's his great discovery of the will. And this is a will that is primarily a will to resist and a will to dominate. The great question for him is, why did God give us a will of that sort? And then the discussion of his book on free will is concerned with how can we be free unless we have the ability to resist God in order to be sinful. And it becomes very complicated and very interesting. With Nietzsche, it's a different kind of problem. Nietzsche thinks of the will as being an affect, which is not anybody's affect. It's a kind of cosmic affect. That is to say, it's a passion or an emotion, but it's not an emotion which belongs to you or me. It's an emotion which is beneath everything, and we are simply instances of it. So there the problem is, what a will can be that isn't any particular human being's will, what a cosmic will can be. I think that's enough pontificating about that.
Dylan, you used the term genealogy earlier to describe what Eva's done in the book, and I think that's a really great term. The one distinction I would make is, if you're thinking of genealogy the way that Foucault uses it, what Eva actually does as part of her genealogy is she points out that we have conflicting and oftentimes misunderstood notions of what we mean when we use the term will, and that different thinkers use the term differently and don't necessarily acknowledge the difference in how they use it versus how it's used in some of the people that they engage with. And I think that's a key point, is that we're talking as if we're talking about one thing. Mm-hmm. But one of the outcomes of the book is the idea that there's kind of these key notions that underline the will versus free will and those sorts of things, but that it's almost as though we have to come to a consensus about what we mean when we say it. Otherwise, we are just doing genealogy or history in order to get to the point where she's going to provide her solution.
And I like that at the end, you represent all the figures and say, well, at least this should show that there's no simple phenomenology of will. It's not like Descartes, I just look inside myself and there's the will. And that is just clearly messed up.
Yeah, that seems to be exactly right. That the other human features that I've been interested in, the imagination, time, negation, there's a kind of general agreement, at least about what they are and how one finds them, that is to say, what the appearances are. When it comes to the will, there's simply no agreement about anything, whether it is a passion, a power, a faculty, a mood, what it does, whether it actually moves anything, or whether it's an epiphenomenon or an illusion, you name it. There is no unanimity, no general agreement. And I took this as a hopeful fact. If there's something which is so elusive, then it ought to be something we can, if we think we ought to, tone it down at least, if not get rid of it.
Right, that it was a peripheral phenomenological occurrence, that there are times, of course, when there's something that you think is right and your passions are pulling you in a different way and you're having to exert willpower to do the right thing. So that's a report of will showing up in everyday experience. But that's not the same as every time you make a decision, you feel the will moving, or I move my arm and I feel the will moving. That's a gross expansion of the term beyond that very specialized, necessary role that it plays in first-person psychology.
That's exactly right. And that was one of the most interesting developments. Thomas Aquinas, who I've already said was a sort of mainstay of this inquiry, has a very extended description of the will as an activity or power of many parts, of many phases, as a long-term sort of engagement. And what people currently think of mostly as will, namely decision-making, that's only a tiny part of it. It's one moment in an extended activity. When it comes to modern will experiments, they all take the will to be a moment of choice or decision. Just one moment. Decide whether to flex your wrist. To me, that has very little to do with the will, and the experiments that go with that kind of inquiry into choice or decision don't seem to me to say anything about the will.
Because they're at best addressing one individual aspect.
Namely that of choosing. But in the grand tradition, will is not primarily a matter of choice. It's a matter of what is called traditionally appetite, that is to say, of a passion of love, and of deliberating or thinking about what it is one ought to love. And then it's never fundamentally free because it's directed by its object. That is to say, love is supposed to be directed toward a good object. Of course, in the Christian tradition, that's God. But from that point of view, will is by its very nature not free because it reaches toward the good.
So I think there's a couple different things going on there that it might be worth going a little more carefully through sections that we chose to read and sort of say a little bit more about,
right,
about them.
Can we just in summary say that the sections of the book that we all agreed to look at were the preface, where you set out, here's what I'm going to do. Chapter one, Before Will, where it talks about just what you were saying, that Socrates, as portrayed by Plato and Aristotle, don't seem to have this notion of the will. Then chapter 2c on Augustine, chapter 3a on Thomas Aquinas, chapter 6a on linguistics, we can get to later, and then the conclusion. So that's just a little slice of the book is what we chose. There were other chapters, as you alluded to, on Nietzsche. There was one on Schopenhauer. Those guys are both brought up just as bugaboos, as people that have this weird transpersonal notion, and many other figures.
What I labored over hardest and longest were the contemporary neuroscientific notions of the will. It was a very lively subject. We'll see if we get through that.
Yes, we can always have you address things. And since we've covered a number of these issues in past episodes, and you actually summarize wonderfully in your conclusion all the chapters that you went through, I almost felt like, what? I didn't need to get all those quotes from Augustine. You just gave a perfectly nice two-paragraph summary of your point there. So I think there's a lot more that we can bring in or have you talk about as the conversation permits.
There may be moments when I can't resist bringing in some of the experiments that.
Please. Yeah, it's fine. So Augustine, right, is what we're going to ask.
Yes.
Can I make a request before we get there?
Please do.
Can you guys just do a quick, and I'm talking about the Greek speakers. You mentioned briefly earlier, Eva, that the Greek word that's usually translated as will doesn't really have that connotation. And in the book, you make a point to say that the whole idea of a will period, but certainly in its modern sense, doesn't even come up until the Stoics. And even then, it's kind of subconscious or hidden. And it's not until it's made explicit by Augustine. So I just would like you to summarize briefly why it is that in Aristotle and Socrates, there isn't really a notion of the will in the way that you...
Yeah, when you ask why it is, you mean what in their way of seeing things prevents the will from arising?
Yes.
Yeah, the best example is, to my mind, Socrates. For Socrates, there is no daylight, so to speak, between wanting and doing, between thinking that something ought to be done, that is, wanting to do it, and doing it. The will is usually thought of as being applied, that's called willpower, right? When you decide that something ought to be, and then the will kicks in, and that makes you do it. And if you don't have any willpower, then you say that's what I ought have done, but it's not what I was able to do. For Socrates to understand something thoroughly and deeply, to have inquired into it, to know how it is fundamentally and at bottom, is to be immediately ready to act accordingly. And without any contortions, without any pain. And the best example of that is the way that he presents himself at his trial. There's never any sign that he had a hard time deciding what to do. He decided that he was not going to be quieted, that he wasn't going to leave Athens. And he died, well, I guess the right word is serenely, because from knowledge to virtue, there is no gap. Mm-hmm. You know what is right to do and you do it. In other words, there's no room for will there, or no need for it.
In that notion, you would understand willpower is acting against some inclination in yourself.
Or some weakness.
As a weakness.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but is there no notion of willpower against essentially external weakness, like the will of a soldier in the sense of overcoming his own fear in the sense of courage, but in doing something very hard, whether it be physically or politically? You have no disagreement with yourself about whether or not it ought to be done, but you're trying to activate some kind of external change that requires willpower on yourself. You keep trying to do it.
That's what I'm saying is not part of Socrates' mental furniture.
Okay.
To know really and truly what courage is, mm-hmm. and there's a dialogue in which that's worked out, is in no way different from being courageous. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it's different insofar as the one is thinking and the other one's acting, but there's no missing link between the two. Willpower becomes necessary if there is some sort of gap between what I know I ought to do and what I can bring myself to do.
But what you're describing makes it sound like Socrates would never, ever be discouraged. And so,
that is,
constitutionally. And so that...
That is probably right.
Okay.
And so, we never meet him in that frame of mind. Now, okay. I'm not saying this is the real Socrates. I'm saying this is the Platonic Socrates.
Sure. Okay.
Isn't this just a question of what we think of as moral? So, for instance, the two conceptions of morality, one in which we will ourselves to do something against our inclinations. It's a different picture of morality in which you're simply habituated into wanting to do the things that are good, as opposed to willing the good in conflict with other inclinations. The inclinations line up with the will. So it's not a question of whether Socrates was ever discouraged. It's a question of whether what we think of as ethical or virtuous action consisting in willing, as Eva points out, has so many different meanings. And that's part of the inherent problem, right? Because on the one hand, at its most basic level, willing is just a lot like desiring. And in many languages, saying I want to do something and I will do something, there's no distinction in language between those two things. And in a way, I think Schopenhauer talks about the will, you know, I think he gets more specific, but there are many times in Schopenhauer when the will sounds a lot like desire and seems synonymous with
well,
desire.
Well, it's assertiveness, yeah.
But on the other hand, the will, in a sense, even in folk psychology, I'm just getting at two different folk meanings of willing. The will is precisely what goes against desire. I'm going to do this, and that's the willpower aspect that you're getting at. So there's inherent contradiction even in everyday usage. On the one hand, there's the desire element, and then on the other hand, there's the contradicting desire aspect. I'm going to do it despite what I want to do aspect of it.
Are you still talking about Schopenhauer here?
Well, I was just using Schopenhauer as an example of someone who often speaks about the will as if it's synonymous with desire, although he is careful. He talks about willing as what it feels like to actually do something. It's the subjective correlate of action. He is careful to say, well, willing is not simply the desire that comes before action. It's something joined to action in the moment. But when he's careful, he talks that way. When he's not careful, he talks about willing as if it's synonymous with desiring. So for instance, aesthetic experience, in the sense that it helps you withdraw from willing, helps you withdraw from desire.
The will for Schopenhauer is, first of all, a transhuman kind of being. In fact, it's very hard to say what kind of thing it is. So what is at the foundation of the world as it represents itself to us, or as we represent it to ourselves, is willing. And that willing is, I think, fundamentally self-assertion. And it is wild and bloody and egotistical self-assertion.
Well, he speaks about it as a striving, right?
It's a striving, but it's a striving that has no mercy. And when it is objectified, that's to say specified in human beings, it is painful and destructive. The interesting thing to me about Schopenhauer is he's the first philosopher that I know of who regards the world in a hopelessly pessimistic way. In other words, the world is a terrible place, except insofar as we can suppress willing. And he thinks that one way to do that is to sublimate it into,
right,
into art, particularly music. And finally, actually, to go into a kind of nirvana state, if one can do that.
A state without desire. I mean, I think the suffering part of it is what I've been calling the desire.
A state without desire, but above all, without striving. Schopenhauer and Nietzsche and Rousseau before him, these are three philosophers whose interesting characteristic to me is that they bring into the cosmos a will that is not a human will, a transhuman, superhuman will, a foundational will. And I have to say that I do not understand what I'm reading, I think, to some degree, but I cannot make sense of it. I don't understand what a will that is not a subject's will, somebody's will, can be. The danger in such a will is that if you build a philosophy on it, and this is true, incidentally, we didn't read Rousseau, but he's in some way fundamental here. Rousseau has a notion of a will that is no one's will in particular. He calls it the general will. Nietzsche has a notion of a will that is at the foundation of all human excellence, and particularly the ability to be in command. Well, it never takes very long before someone decides that they are truly the incarnation of this will. And at that moment, you have some sort of political totalitarianism. So that seems to me, of all the appearances of the will, the most dangerous and the one most to be resisted, as the will as defined in Rousseau, Schopenhauer, and Nietzsche.
Well, and you're giving us a good example of the way in which philosophy interacts with culture,
yes,
right? The part of a genealogy here is not just how one brilliant thinker read other brilliant thinkers before them. It's actually, most of these brilliant thinkers think that they're coming up with most of this from scratch. Of course, Nietzsche cribbed very self-consciously from Schopenhauer, and there are lots of connections like that. But still, they're reacting on the things that are floating around in the culture. And so the question is, whatever subtleties might have gone into Schopenhauer's account of will, such that you'd say, oh, come on, if you're a good reading of Schopenhauer, there's no way you would think that that leads to totalitarianism. It still can be a historical fact that these things, as they permeate into the culture, have in a very predictable way these negative consequences.
I don't think so. German nationalism was a problem while Nietzsche was writing, and Nietzsche rails against German nationalism. In a way, much of his polemic is directed against precisely that point of view. That he was misused later, I don't see that as a historical influence on the development of German nationalism. It was a countercurrent that was ironically co-opted to justify it after the fact.
I think that's what Mark is saying, that it's predictable in the way that certain types of ideas will get co-opted for totalitarian and ideological purposes. There are some ideas that lend themselves more to that kind of co-option.
It seems to me that it's perfectly true that Nietzsche borrows, one might say shamelessly, from Schopenhauer. But, of course, he does it the way all these borrowings are done, namely by distancing himself from what he sees in Schopenhauer and taking the same thing in a different mode, so that it's hard to try to find a political consequence in Schopenhauer. But in Nietzsche, that becomes a very, very big problem. There are people who hold Nietzsche in some way responsible for what happened in the 20th century. And it seems to me there's a point in that. If you write utterly charming prose, which he does, and you win a whole nation's heart, and in what you're saying, there is a worship of commanding willfulness and of the fact that this is a rare phenomenon and only very few people are called to it, you're asking for totalitarianism, so it seems to me.
Before we continue our conversation, I want to give a shout out to our friends at St. John's College Graduate Institute. The Graduate Institute is the master's degree-granting arm of St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Annapolis, Maryland. Most of you listening are dedicated to the thoughtful reading of and serious conversation about the greatest books ever written. The Graduate Institute attracts a community of fellows who are passionate about the life of the mind. All classes at the Graduate Institute are, like PEL episodes, discussions, conversations. The books are the teachers, and the faculty members are tutors who come together to learn as well. In fact, this week, I'm talking to you from St. John's College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I've been teaching the Summer Classics program, working on Chekhov short stories. A group of 18 students from all over the country have been participating in discussions on A Boring Story, The Seagull, and a variety of other Chekhov short stories. And we have been having both a wonderful time, and I've been learning something in every class. I can't recommend the Summer Classics enough, and as an extension of the kind of experience that you have at the Graduate Institute, I can't recommend it more highly. The Graduate Institute is currently accepting applications for fall and spring terms. Applications are accepted and decisions made at any time on a rolling basis. There is no application fee, and the only requirement is a bachelor's degree in any field. In addition to degree-granting programs, the Graduate Institute at St. John's sponsors summer educational opportunities like the one that I've been participating in this week, including a 9-week Ancient Greek Institute, an 8-week Film Institute program, and a 2-week-long Science Institute program. For more information, visit partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI. That's partiallyexaminedlife.com/SJCGI.
All right, thanks, Dylan.
Hey, folks. We've partnered with Paul Dry Books, publisher of Eva's book, Unwilling, that we are covering in this episode, as well as The Logos of Heraclitus from episode 79 and 10 other of her titles, to offer you 30% off and free shipping in the U.S. and only $25 flat rate shipping internationally. Go to pauldrybooks.com and enter PEL in the comments at checkout. Take a look at our blog for more details on this great offer.
So before that interruption, Eva had just laid down the gauntlet regarding the ultimately pernicious effect of Nietzsche's doctrine of the will to power.
I expect to hear objections to that.
I mean, I don't want to get us on a derail this conversation, but I think the weakest part of Nietzsche is the elitism, but I don't see that as the main current of his argument.
Part of the question is, even if it isn't part of Nietzsche's own main current of his argument, is the way in which it gets co-opted so hard to understand?
That's a historical question, and I don't think many historians agree with you that Nietzsche was a huge influence in the development of German nationalism when it was already around and he was railing against it.
Yeah, this isn't so much a question of nationalism. You're absolutely right that Nietzsche was a great opponent of vulgar nationalism. It's more about the question whether the will to power, which is, after all, his term, is located in certain human beings whom to resist is to resist the most fundamental way things are. And it's very hard to erase that in Nietzsche.
Right, but I think the central argument is, in a way, a lot like Schopenhauer's, except it stops short of religion. It's an argument for sublimation, for this sort of synthesis of artist and philosopher. I think what Nietzsche is railing against, in a way, is it's the same thing that Freud is objecting to later as well. It's the perniciousness of what happens when you suppress instinct. Less than the valorization of will, I see him as objecting to the hypocrisy of pretending that we can be willless creatures. And he may be wrong about that, but and then he wants to find a solution to that. I see the solution more having to do with the role of the artist in society, as opposed to, especially in his later writing, there's lots of elitist incendiary stuff, but I don't see it as the main thrust.
Well, and it's a very felicitous, the Walter Kaufmann genial Nietzsche that we favor in our own discussions goes very well with the goal that you set out yourself, Eva, at the end of the book of this curiosity and joy and stuff. But I thought that it was instructive in what is a genealogy and what's going on in this book here. Genealogies are not about intelligent philosophers learning, taking the best out of the previous philosophers and adding to them. They're about sort of mistakes, right? Think about the master-slave story that Nietzsche tells about slave morality taking over master morality. It's about disparate individuals who don't even really fully understand each other, evolving ideas over time. So it's a sociological account. And I don't even think you can confuse a genealogical account with a historical account. The question is not, did Nietzsche's idea of the will actually influence German nationalism? But do we see in the idea of a transpersonal will with a focus on greatness and domination, whether it's domination over yourself, domination over others, a natural superiority, do we see in that the seeds, right? So she's giving a hermeneutic look at history. It's not necessarily what led to what as historical events, but how can we look at these patterns of ideas such that she can highlight the things she wants to highlight, and it leads to the desired point.
Yeah, I'm just saying that for Nietzsche, like Schopenhauer, I think the will is actually a problem and not a solution. It's a problematic thing that human beings have to figure out how to deal with, ultimately.
Could you say what the problem is?
The problem is, if everything is ultimately will to power, then how you live your life without constant conflict and suffering.
Yeah, not with yourself suffering, but particularly imposing suffering on others, which for Nietzsche is a very important aspect of the commanding will. But look, if you say that this is an unsolved problem, then Nietzsche altogether is an unsolved problem. By the way, I would agree with that. I mean, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that Nietzsche and Schopenhauer are actually quite similar. The will is a problem, and their solution has to do with, for Schopenhauer, it's this withdrawal from the will through art on the one hand or religion on the other. Nietzsche is trying to solve the same problem. He's modifying the Schopenhauerian solution to that because he doesn't think that this withdrawal from will is actually possible, and he thinks it's sort of hypocritical that religion, for instance, involves a hypocritical pretense to withdraw from the will. So, for instance, aesthetic experience for Nietzsche, the gay science makes this very clear. He's critical of this idea that it involves simply withdrawing from the will. It's a way of giving expression to the will, especially giving expression to instinct. You know, I think it actually squares with this general question, Eva, that you're asking, because I think you're asking for a solution as well. And I think will is problematic in some sense, and the unwilling approach is one solution to that.
So when you speak of the will as a problem, see, to me, that has two meanings, and I kept wondering which one you were putting first. Do you mean that how to deal with the will is a problem, or do you mean that what the will is the problem in both Schopenhauer and Nietzsche?
I think the problem is the sense in which it can be a source of suffering, you know, in Schopenhauer, and for Nietzsche, a source of...
So how to deal with it?
Nihilism. As a last-ditch attempt at meaningfulness, as an attempt at meaningfulness in life gone wrong.
What about this way of looking at it? How to deal with the will is a problem that follows from the fact that they've established the kind of will that you have to deal with. Now, isn't the real problem the introduction of such a will into philosophy and into a popular thinking.
So you're thinking of the willpower version of the will, or the Augustinian version? Is that what you're thinking of now? Or?
Well, I'm thinking of the notion of a will, the will to power, particularly in Nietzsche's case, as being the fundamental cosmic force. The problem seems to me that one should say such a thing to begin with, that once you've said it, the problem of dealing with it follows, seems to me a derivative problem. But first, why conceive of it that way? In other words, what are the responsibilities of a philosopher who brings such a notion into the world? And it seems to me that he can't protect himself by saying that he's writing for some and not for others. Once you publish a book, anybody can read it. So he really captivated much of Europe with his books. So there has to be some responsibility for the consequences. Does that seem wrong?
Yeah, I think we disagree about whether there were actual consequences, but
okay.
Let's talk about that dastardly Augustine.
Yeah.
That guy.
Back to Augustine.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
his fault.
So I wanted to quote the first part of your discussion of Augustine. So you talk about three different books on Augustine.
And the Confessions is really the most.
Yeah. At the end of the discussion of the first one, which was on the free choice.
On free choice.
Yeah. At the end of that section, you say, "So concludes the founding charter of the West's will, a distinct power given by God to thinking creatures so that there may be freedom in his law-ruled creation. Thus, it is a power for receiving and obeying commands. Hence, it has an explicitly defining propensity for disobedience, because the exercise of free choice requires the ever-ready capacity to reject a command. When sound, the will cleaves to the unchangeable eternal common law that rationality informs God's creation, but in defection, it is perverse, turned wrongly inward as self-will, self-subjected to private law, a deprived, privative privacy, expressed as the law of lust, of libido and cupidity, excitation and possession, which by its very turning inward becomes enslaved to external things. The ultimate expression of this lust is dominion for its own sake, pride and self-deification being grounded in unintelligible nothingness." And then you go on to characterize Confessions as Augustine speaking of the will that is embodied in a human being as a source of suffering. This seems to be decisive. Like here, will is...
This is novel.
Okay.
There never was anything like this before in anything I've read in antiquity. And the novelty is, first of all, in introducing what he himself calls a faculty, a power, namely power to be perverse. Why is it primarily a power to be perverse? Because if it weren't that, it wouldn't be free.
Okay, so I want to get right back to that. But what is the difference with, say, the earlier Greeks, Socrates and Aristotle, is that the will is not a faculty. The activity of the soul is just that. It's an activity. And what you would call will is not a separate power of the soul.
If I may just agree with that in this way. Both Plato and Aristotle, and the Stoics also, have schemata, tables of the soul, right, which tell you what the faculties of the soul are. And none of them is there anything that has the name will or has the characteristics of will. That's what you just...
Yes. But I guess I was also looking to think of when you say that Augustine invents will in the West, it is the notion of doing bad things.
It's the notion of the ability to resist good.
To resist good.
The good being God and subsidiary goods being beings of creation, and the ability to say no to the commands of God and to resist the beings that are good in the world. That's the primary new characteristic that is embodied in this new notion, which he calls will voluntas.
When you talk about Confessions, you bring up the famous scene of the pears.
That's an example.
Yeah, and since we haven't read Augustine yet for PEL, maybe you could recount that section.
He and a bunch of boys, I think they were 14 young adolescents, went into somebody else's garden that had a pear tree that had very nasty bitter, unpleasant fruit, and they collected sacks of them. The point was, at least for Augustine, I don't know, the other boys gave it another thought. It was a lark. But for Augustine, it means that he engaged in evil doing for the sake of transgression. He didn't want the fruits of this evil doing. He didn't do what he did in order to get something he wanted. He did it in order to be bad.
You quote him as saying, I loved my own fault.
And this is what sinfulness is.
In that
not
way,
doing wrong, but loving it.
In that way, it's the birth of the will, because this is the most clear sign of willfulness, is doing something sinful for its own sake.
So how does this not just follow from the denial of the Socratic view that everybody tends toward the good? That it seems even some of the people that Socrates was arguing against in his dialogues, if you just deny that everybody is oriented toward the good, in fact, I could just recognize the good, but yet choose the opposite.
Wait, it's not that everyone is oriented towards the good. They're oriented towards what they believe to be good, which is often wrong.
Yes, I will accept the correction, but so you don't think any of the people that Socrates is arguing against actually would deny that?
Would deny what?
Would deny everybody pursues what they perceive to be good, because it seems that's all you need to get the will as you're describing it here. And it seems that's a very controversial point within Socrates that he has to spend a lot of work to argue for. And so it would be surprising if the entirety of antiquity somehow was represented by that view, that then Augustine was the first to state the contrary.
I think, first of all, that what you say is right, that the notion that good is what people want, just as happiness is the possession of good and therefore what people want, that is the view both of Socrates, of Plato, and of Aristotle, and of all the other ancient philosophers that I've read about. Now, human beings probably would differ on this, but in the dialogues, at least, people don't disagree with that. They agree that they want something good. And that attitude that is so familiar to us of wanting to not only sadism, but of masochism, of enjoying being bad, of enjoying sin. As I say, I imagine that many people were that way, but it's not an officially recognized category. And that seems to be interesting.
And we certainly wouldn't see it among the ancient tragedian heroes or anything like that, or the villains in their pieces.
A little bit in Euripides, you begin to get the notion of doing things to hurt yourself. But certainly in Aeschylus and Sophocles, that's not a thought that anyone officially thinks. I'm not arguing that there weren't people who were sinful in the Christian sense of the word, but rather that it's not a category that the people who write recognize. And that's, of course, all we can go by, what there is in the literature. And that seems to me remarkable. It would be interesting. I'd like to sort of challenge the world to produce a line from a Greek author of the 5th or 4th or 3rd or 2nd century before the Common Era.
Well, I was more thinking in the Bible.
Oh, yeah, that's the other tradition. The other tradition, they know all about that.
Okay.
That's after all, the Old Testament stands behind the discovery of sin in Christianity. I absolutely agree.
Okay, so you're actually teaching us another thing about tracing a genealogy. You're not saying Augustine was the first one in history to invent it, but you're saying within this Western philosophical tradition, Augustine is where this notion actually gets sketched out.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And in bringing in the Old Testament, when you think of the Old Testament, something becomes explicit about that, that notion of sinfulness, that is to say, of perversion of the will, of a desire to do bad for the sense of doing evil. In order for that to come about, you need the notion of a God who made you, of a creator God, whom to rebel against. And the Greeks don't have that. The gods didn't make them. The gods, they have a much more relaxed attitude toward their gods.
It may be new that Augustine is reflecting on himself and his own, you know, in this anecdote that you related, his own desire to do evil, where I think it's all too common to say people in the in-group, they want the good, and everybody else are just loathsome creatures by nature. And it's actually a cultural accomplishment to say, oh, they too want the good. They just don't understand what the good is. That it may be a fundamental thing to cast them as demonic, the other.
That works perfectly with the notion I'm trying to formulate, because they want the good. It's a different good. But the public mode of speaking about it is still that of goodness. The matter at issue here is that sin, evil, becomes desirable. In other words, the new will, Augustine's new will, is a will that makes sinfulness desirable as being self-assertion against the Creator. It's a form of rebellion.
Yeah, so this isn't just wanting something pleasurable, even though we know it's ultimately bad for us.
Yeah, but no, it doesn't even have to be pleasurable. It could be nasty.
Right. This is wanting something bad because of the...
Just wanting to be bad. Look, I'll tell you why I believe that every Greek mother knew about sinfulness, even if it was not a public category, because I can't imagine that Greek babies didn't have, infants didn't have the terrible twos. The terrible twos are the incarnation of sinfulness, that is to say, of willful rebellion, which isn't about getting something, but it's just about being rebellious.
Yeah.
Can I tell a short anecdote of sinfulness?
It's about getting independence, though, right?
Yeah, about independence, right. I was babysitting a kid, you know, and I was eating a bologna sandwich. He'd had his lunch, and I said, "Do you want some of my bologna sandwich?" He said, "Nah." And before long, he'd wrested it from my fingers and was eating it. That was sheer willfulness. So I do believe that there's always been willfulness. What I'm simply arguing is that it didn't have a formulation. And Augustine is the formulator of this new notion.
But it sounds to me that to the extent that you're wanting to undo some of that formulation, there's something distinctly problematic about the formulation, at least the consequences, best undesirable. Because in that what you just said about Greek mothers and the presence of this kind of willfulness, that is wanting to do bad, you're not denying that that exists as a category, but that there's something about Augustine's formulation and what it leads to that you want to undo. And so maybe
the reason it's a serious matter with two-year-olds, terrible two-year-olds, they get over it. You know, one day, everything's sweetness and light for a while, until adolescence, when it comes right back. But the reason that this is serious, because it's so closely connected to the notion of freedom and independence. Mm-hmm. And it raises the question whether freedom and human independence aren't in some way allied to perversity. I don't think so, especially in freedom of choice. Augustine actually thinks that.
So that in Augustine, you have the clearest manifestation of our freedom of choice is actually in doing perverse things.
Yes.
Perverse is defined by the Creator God and the ethos.
I think the notion of a God who made us is essential to the discovery of this category, but it's not essential to holding on to it.
Yeah, perverse, just the word, I think, is getting at the turning against. So the turning against God aspect of this, the defiant, not perverse in some other sense.
There's a nice quote, Eva, in your book where you say, sin is the first parent of will. In a certain sense, I see you as allied with Nietzsche to some extent, but this also came up recently. I was in a debate about free will, like a public debate, and there's a naturalist movement, you know, it's particularly championed by scientists, but they draw a strong parallel. They make a point of saying that the notion of free will or choice is very closely aligned with the notion of sin, and that you can't unwind that idea of freedom of choice from a notion of having some kind of moral responsibility in the eyes of that Creator God. And I'm very sympathetic to what I see you as wanting to point towards something that sets us free from this notion of sin, which has the attendant things such as guilt, and try to, by reaching back to Socrates, but also pointing forward to something else, highlight the fact that as long as we're sort of tied to this notion of will, we are going to get caught up in these discussions, which are inevitably going to bring in that, I'll call it ideology, that monotheistic Creator God ideology.
Yeah, that sounds right to me, if that's an interpretation of what I meant, yeah.
It's an interpretation.
Yes.
I'm glad you brought up the anecdote about the children, because you know it seems strange to say Augustine invented this when surely we see it all around us. But just to give a sort of simplified example, because it's hard to get our hands on what will is, the notion that everybody acts selfishly. So another way to interpret the little children's action is that they're being selfish. And we can acknowledge that people act that way, and then we could talk to them as Socrates does and try to bring them to accord to say, oh, really what you're trying to do is go towards some good, but then actually the good is shared among us. You know, everybody's still sort of reasonable, potentially admitting that people take actions that, like little kids' actions, appear as selfish. If you promote everybody acts selfishly all the time to be a philosophical principle, then what are the behavioral outcomes of having that be a thing in the popular culture? Well, people could either embrace it, greed is good, and have a horrible society in that way, or the people that reject that then engage on this sort of altruism, the kind that Nietzsche doesn't like, that he thinks is sort of ignoring human nature, try to remake yourself in a way that completely ignores what you're about. And so either of those options, as opposed as they might appear, are reactions to admitting this one point of philosophy, admitting it as a psychological fact, so that there's, you know, a big difference between observing, going back to your example, that little kids have wills, or that people act willfully in many circumstances, to seeing as a fundamental phenomenological fact that we are driven by the will.
You know, it seems to me that egotism is the most innocent of notions compared to willfulness. Egotism is just wanting things and not caring how you get them, if necessary. I mean, kids are terribly selfish in that way. You know, I worked in a kindergarten for a while. Kids take things away from each other if they want them. Sinfulness is more complex and, I think, more wicked. Selfishness isn't nice, but sinfulness is perverse. And the reason is that in the one case, it's a kind of innocent desire to acquire things, to have them. But in the other case, it's a desire to dominate, to impose yourself, to command, to deny obedience where obedience is really required. So it seems to me that sin is not the same as selfishness. That selfishness is relatively innocent.
But I mean, isn't part of the problem with Augustine's view is, even though it's rooted in this notion of sinfulness, it ends up being its own solution from Augustine's point of view. That is, while the epitome of willfulness is being sinful, the cure for that is the clenched fist notion of the will. You are going to harden your will against itself, and you're going to will against your own will.
You will to will.
You will to will.
Yes. And that, of course, is the complexity. Mm-hmm. Some authors think that that's, for instance, Hobbes thinks that's a terrible way to, doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that seems right to me, that to will is both the sin and the solution to the sin.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
For Augustine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems very different to say that, you know, Augustine has discovered that sin is an ontological option for us. We can either go with God's commands or we can turn away from God's commands. That seems much less problematic than to say people are fundamentally driven by sin, that we are fundamentally sinful, which is also a thing that Augustine thinks, and that makes him very much in a line if you think that Nietzsche's view is people are fundamentally driven by a will to power. To say people are fundamentally driven by sin, that leads to exactly the kind of, well, either I embrace that or I, with a clenched fist, try to fight against that and end up kind of a weird, pathetic excuse for a human being, you know, at least according to Nietzsche's analysis.
So one might conclude from that, and I think that is my conclusion, that the clenched fist or willing to will resolution to willfulness is just another way of getting entangled in the same way. And that some way has to be found out which is more a relaxation than a further ratcheting up of willfulness. And that's what I try to delineate in the conclusion.
And with that, we come to the conclusion of part one of our discussion. Be sure to tune in next week to hear more about Ava's positive project, her vision for life, and how her account of will hooks up with the free will debates that occupy contemporary philosophy. Hey, on Monday, August 3rd, we're going to have a drawing for 5 listeners to win a free copy of Ava's book, Unwilling. The only thing you have to do to enter is become a Partially Examined Life citizen. And if you do that, then you won't have to wait till next week to hear part two. You can get the whole thing right now at our website, partiallyexaminedlife.com, where you can use our citizens-only feed, which beams all the recent episodes, complete and ad-free, as well as bonus audio, including after-shows and not-school discussions, and those older episodes that are no longer on the public feed, straight to your mobile device using an application such as Downcast for iOS or Podcast Republic for Android. For details, please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us. Talk to you soon.